Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time listening to the Guelph Politicast, welcome. Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or are just making life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or subscribe on iTunes. This week, I'm going to try something a bit different, and we're going to have multiple interviews on the same show. Sebastian Silva, Joan Jalan, and Lloyd Longfield are all coming up on this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast, but first, a public service announcement. Last week, I launched the Patreon campaign for Guelph Politico. Through Patreon, you can contribute on a per-monthly basis of any amount you feel comfortable using PayPal or your credit card, and all the money goes to maintaining a locally sourced, independent media outlet in Guelph called Guelph Politico. Through your generous donations, you will be paying to keep the Politicast going, as well as regular coverage of city council and politics in and around and concerning the Royal City. So for more details, click on the giant orange P on the right-hand side of the Guelph Politico page, or go to patreon.com/Guelph Politico. Now on with the show. First up on this week's episode, someone who's trying to put electoral fraud back on the radar. You may have missed it at the tail end of the last phase of the Duffy trial, but in the testimony of Senator Mike Duffy, was the implication that conservative operatives were behind a robocall that misled voters in Saanich Gulf Islands in 2008. A call claiming to be from the NDP candidate who had dropped out of the race, but whose name was still on the ballot, potentially divided the vote, allowing Conservative Cabinet Minister Gary Lund to squeak out a win in that riding in 2008. Now, one person who did notice the Duffy testimony was Sebastian Silva, a resident of Salt Spring Island in the Saanich Gulf Islands riding. Silva was a resident of that riding in 2008 and has been advocating to get to the bottom of the robocall mystery for the last 7 years. And upon hearing Duffy's testimony, he fired off a letter dated December 30th to Elections Canada investigators asking them to reopen the case. And in just a few short weeks, he got a letter back from Eric Farron, Senior Director of Investigation at Elections Canada. It wasn't the answer he wanted, but Silva's hope is that it's a positive sign that the book hasn't been completely closed on getting justice for the events of 2008 and 2011. I talked to Sebastian Silva the other day by phone from British Columbia.
So, you've been living with this since the beginning as a resident. In terms of the mood, you took it upon yourself to write the letter, but I assume, like in Guelph and what happened here in 2011 with the robocalls, this is still a big issue for people in your area as well, what happened in 2008.
Yeah, it's still on everybody's minds. It was a big mystery as to what happened. It was clear that somebody had cheated and made those calls, telling them to vote for a candidate who dropped out. And, the message went out to voters said that it was coming from the NDP office. So they had spoofed their number, and the NDP denied it at the time, also complained to Elections Canada. So it was obvious that somebody cheated. And Elections Canada was never able to get to the bottom of it, basically just telling us that they couldn't figure out who had done it. Nor did they think it had an influence on the outcome, which is difficult for us to understand, because a lot of people seem to have been affected by it, and they never reveal how they investigate, so we don't know how thoroughly that was investigated. And besides, that is not the point, because they acted fraudulently trying to take a voter's vote away, or just to try and influence them fraudulently in their vote. Is the crime. Whether or not it was successful is not the point. It's just like robbing a bank. You can get away with the money or not. You still committed a crime. So
that's right.
So the mood is that it's unresolved. It's still on everybody's minds. It has been for the last 7 years. And so now this new allegation from the Senate inquiry by Duffy saying that, it'd been some black ops team from Ottawa sort of validated that what we've felt and known in our hearts since then. And so we want to get to the bottom of it and have some closure.
Yeah, and it was a bit of a bad timing, for wanting to get air on this issue. It happened right before Christmas. It happened at kind of the tail end of the last phase of the Duffy trial. Did you think that it got enough media attention? There was a bit of a small mention on the CBC when it happened, but it seemed to sort of fly past the plate, to use a sports metaphor, didn't really seem to get a lot of play considering the implications.
Yeah, I think that's an issue that a lot of people are bringing up, a lot of journalists, a lot of residents. I'm not sure what it is with Canadians and news cycles. I don't know if it's people cheating during an election, and an allegation of that nature coming from such a high level, you know, under oath, you'd think would get more airtime. But I think, like you said, it was Christmas time, and the trial is resuming in a couple of weeks. And so I know that we haven't heard the last of this. And now I suspect there's increased pressure on Elections Canada to re-look at this issue and at least question some of the players as to really what happened. It seems like there's another layer of intrigue that's opened up. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that's the danger right now with a new government in Ottawa is people will say, well, that old government is gone, and so, you know, we don't really have to deal with those types of things. But I think that really does not do justice to the fact that in two elections now, people try to cheat, and it's part of a consistent pattern of abuse of our electoral process where, people either cheat or intimidate or, you know, release rumors about candidates and, or worse, to, you know, try to send them to the wrong polling station. And I think if it's not investigated and taken seriously, I think it's there's a real danger of it happening again in the future. So I think it's important for Canadians, not in a witch hunt type of way. I think we owe it to ourselves and to our democracy to get to the bottom of it, to find out who was involved. I've been circulating an idea, which I don't think everybody would support, but I think it's almost at the point where I would almost create some sort of, you know, amnesty or some reconciliation type process where if people come forward who were, you know, involved in recording some of these messages, or, you know, if they're prepared to come forward and tell the truth and to say, hey, you're not going to go to jail and you're, you know, it will, because I think it's more important for us to find out what happened and who, if there was high level direction, to find out who was involved in giving that direction, because in Guelph, it happened in dozens of riding, if not hundreds. Right. So it was clearly a coordinated sort of project or attempt to influence the 2011 election. So, I think getting to the bottom of it is more important. And even if the high-level people who were involved behind it, you know, thought, oh, we'll just trick them a bit, and they didn't think it so seriously, even if they were involved and they come forward, I'm not saying that they shouldn't sort of have some form of punishment, but I think it's more important to get to the bottom of it and for us to heal from it and to move on as a country and to look at some really important issues we're facing. But it can't be forgotten. So there's a lot of good people who are behind this issue. You're asking about it. I know Council of Canadians is on it. Fair Vote is on it. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of people out here as well. And I'm hoping that Elizabeth May, who's been a big supporter of this issue because she is our member of parliament, will continue to ask about it, and that the authorities who are empowered to investigate these types of things, Elections Canada, you know, the Director of Public Prosecutions, potentially the RCMP, that they will take this matter seriously and just get to the bottom of it, because we owe it to ourselves and to our democracy.
Yeah, and you make a good point about the change in government and how, you know, some people might think it's over. And the letter you sent in, or rather the letter you got back from Elections Canada, obviously doesn't say explicitly that the case has been reopened, but neither does it say explicitly that there's nothing going on either. I don't know if that's a function of the legalese that they have to serve for sort of a them winking at you in response to your letter saying, you know, that we are aware of this, but how do you read it?
I think that's fair. I know there's a lot of good people at Elections Canada that care about the electoral process, and they're under a lot of pressures, mm-hmm. Political and otherwise, particularly just in the last government cycle. And there's this idea that maybe they have to pick their battles and who they prosecute. But to me, any crime, electoral crime, deserves to be looked at and followed up on. And, you know, I have to say that we were quite disappointed in how the 2008 Global Cost scandal was handled. To not be able to figure out who did it. The calls may have come from the state, so there's a cross-border connection. You know, it really feels like they dropped the ball on it. And, you know, to me, regardless, if really they could not get to the bottom of it, to me, a crime does not get, you don't close the case.
Right.
Somebody goes missing 20 years later, it's an unresolved crime. And to me, that for them to say, and therefore we have closed the investigation, was really disappointing because we rely on these institutions to ensure the integrity of our systems and to have some accountability. So for that to just say, okay, well, case closed, it was a sad state of affairs. And it's really hard if they don't reveal their methods and what they've done. There's, I don't know, I guess maybe it's the Election Act that doesn't, you know, the Electoral Act that doesn't allow it.
Right.
But to me, what it says is, you know, there's a line in the letter that they send back in response to the initial that I sent through saying, no, but we did say that if ever there was new information that has come to light, that we would look at it. So to me, you know, I think they are perhaps suggesting that, you know, because of this new information, they are looking at it. And to be quite honest with you, even if it's gotten limited airtime by the media, I don't know how Elections Canada could not investigate after,
right.
You know, a sitting senator says that there was, you know, cheating that happened in that riding and that the fraudulent phone calls were made by certain parties. Like, I don't think Elections Canada can ignore it. I think it's put them too much in the spotlight. So I do hope they are investigating.
Well, I think that the speed at which they turned around your letter, because you wrote the letter on at the end of the year, the 30th, I think, and they got back to you by the middle of January. So, I mean, that might speak to the urgency they have.
Yeah, I mean, I think they, like I said, there's probably lots of good people in there who believe in the integrity of our political system. So, you're right, maybe the timeline does suggest they're taking it seriously and they're moving on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me wrap up by asking, are you confident now, or do you have maybe greater confidence now that there may be some kind of justice done for you and the other residents of your riding in this particular case, even almost going on 10 years after the fact now?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's a glimmer of hope. We had almost lost that hope, and, you know, so it does feel like finally, given all the effort that people put into campaigns, so all the volunteers, the candidates who sacrificed so much of their time for 1 or 2 years of their lives and their families and all the people who invest in them, who believe in them, who support them financially. Again, like I said, the volunteers who spend their weekends knocking on doors, it's really disrespectful.
Mm-hmm.
For people to cheat and think that they can just, oh, we'll send them to the wrong polling station, ha, 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 dirty tricks. It's really disrespectful to people who really care about our system to not, you know, prosecute and go after the people who cheat, because, you know, this is what our country is built on. It's the average person, everybody who can be a member of the House of Commons or their legislative assemblies or municipal council, and people invest a lot of their lives in that. So it's not a joke. It's, you know, it's respect. Not just the integrity of the system, but respect for the people in it, and so that we are hopeful. You know, that being said, in 2011 there were robocalls right across the country, so I do hope that that this is also a platform to look at them. You know, the systemic abuse that happened in 2011 as well,
mm-hmm.
And for us to close some loopholes in the sort of the rules that guide our elections, so that political parties do have to share. Or have privacy laws that regulate their lists, and so they aren't sharing them necessarily with companies that might do spoof calls and third-party advertisers. There's very clear rules to what they can do. It can't be these sort of puppet groups that spring up to spend money to support a candidate just before the election. So I do hope it's an opportunity to look at the issue of our elections. And I do have a bit of hope that finally Gulf Islands will have the due consideration placed on getting to the bottom of it. And I just want to say that I think another issue that's really important is that the reason that these types of sort of dirty tricks are used in politics are usually found in first past the post tech systems.
Mm-hmm.
Because the margin of victory between, we saw in 2011, a majority government, it could be just a handful of seats, right?
Right.
And, could be a few a dozen votes in a couple of key ridings that are identified as swing ridings. So I think that going to a more proportional type of system or a single transferable vote, or multi-voting, where people have more of an interest to be civil because they may want to get the votes from the second place, be their second choice for some of the voters, will take out some of that hyper-partisanship that leads to wanting to cheat or the incentives to cheat because the stakes are so high. So, I'm looking forward to Canada having a good discussion about its electoral system as well. And I think that's going to help.
That was Sebastian Silva, and you can read the letter he got in response from Elections Canada below. Obviously, robocalls on electoral reform remain important issues to us here in Guelph, and we'll be following up on any events as they become available. Next, the City of Guelph held a workshop this week on affordable housing in the city. Staff are currently in consultations with citizens on what measures can be taken to foster development of affordable housing in Guelph, and Tuesday's workshops were a part of that. After the afternoon session, I got the chance to sit down with Senior Policy Planner Joan Jalan to talk about the demands and the challenges of crafting an affordable housing strategy in the City of Guelph.
Okay, so first of all, there were a lot of different definitions at play. So this was about affordable housing, not necessarily social housing, which are two entirely different animals.
Right. So when we at the city look at housing for our community, we want to see a full range of housing. Mm-hmm. And there is a continuum of housing. Like, we look at people that are homeless. We look at people that need transitional housing, mm-hmm. emergency shelter, supportive housing. And then we get into market housing, and we have renters and we have owners. Mm-hmm. So throughout this process, we've been trying to be very respectful of the different roles mm-hmm. that levels of government have and see what can we do with what our roles and responsibilities are and how can we help others
right.
that might have different roles that are connected to what's happening or not happening in our community. So the County of Wellington mm-hmm. is the service manager for the City of Guelph and the county municipalities. Mm-hmm. And they're dealing with sort of the homelessness and the social housing, emergency shelters, that end of the continuum. Mm-hmm. And they've done a 10-year housing and homelessness plan to see what can we do to deal with those issues and that need, given the large waiting list that we have. So when the city looks at how can we assist with that, we do budget, I think we pay 60% of the social housing costs, mm-hmm. and this year that was over $17 million, mm-hmm. to the county to be able to provide that service. And what we're looking at is what can we do on our end for the direct services we provide. So when we look at affordable housing, we deal with the planning for the City of Guelph, mm-hmm. and the province requires us to have that full range, and the province has a definition of what's affordable ownership and rental.
Right.
So this strategy is about the affordable rental and ownership housing in our community, mm-hmm. not the other end of the spectrum, which is the supportive housing and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So we've done a lot of analysis on what are low to moderate income households in our community for renters and for homeowners,
mm-hmm.
and what are house prices and rental rates in our community. And we've been able to quantify what an affordable rent and an affordable house price is in our community. So it's unique to us.
Right.
And using the definitions that the province provides, so other municipalities need to go through the same exercise. So our strategy found that in 2013, using that data,
mm-hmm.
an affordable house price was $294,000 and an affordable rent was $944 per month.
So the point of a strategy like this isn't is to help facilitate sort of leveling the playing field that people who may not be able to access a house or an apartment on the open market with whatever market forces therein. With affordable housing, with housing specifically set aside as affordable, they can access that.
Well, really what the strategy is about is First of all, defining what is affordable housing in our community, mm-hmm. so we know what is that level that we consider affordable. And we also had to define targets. Right. So how much of the new housing needs to be affordable? And each municipality within the province of Ontario has different targets. And we came out with a target of 30% overall, and 27% of all the new housing is to be ownership, and 3% is to be rental.
Mm-hmm.
So the other piece of the strategy was to find out how are we dealing against that target.
Right.
So the ultimate goal is to make sure we have that range of housing, and that range includes affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
So how are we doing with that? So based on our current targets, the strategy is showing we're meeting our ownership targets, but mm-hmm. we're not meeting our rental targets. So what can we do to help with our rental targets, and what other issues are happening in our housing market that we can help try to solve? What kind of actions could we do, recognizing the city's roles and responsibilities? We can't control financial markets,
right.
but we need to understand them.
Mm-hmm.
Just like we can't control what the service manager rules are around provision and administration of social housing and homelessness right. programs, but we could be a stakeholder to that process and try to make some connections with it.
So how are we doing in terms of, because you said we're actually doing pretty good on the ownership side, but the rental side seems to be where the difficulty is. And the difficulty isn't not we have a lot of affordable rental units available. The fact is we don't have enough.
Right. So we have a number of challenges on the rental end of things. First of all, rental households tend to have lower incomes.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's more struggle for them to try to find something affordable in the market. The other big challenge is on the supply end of things. We're just not seeing new purpose-built or primary rental units being created, whether they're affordable or not.
Mm-hmm.
When we looked at our community over the last 5 years, we found that we've exceeded the 27% for ownership housing,
mm-hmm.
but we haven't met the 3% target in any year. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think the only affordable rental housing that has been purposely built in our community was for seniors.
Right.
So really a lot of our issues are recognizing both the ability of renter households to afford something and the supply of affordable housing that might even be out there.
And then there's this tricky thing with rentals too, where there's primary rentals. Correct me if I'm wrong, where I build an apartment building and I'm going to rent all the apartments, that's a primary rental. But if I go down to Waterloo Street and buy a house and turn it into student apartments, that's a secondary rental.
Right. So primary rental is purpose-built.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody, as you said, is renting out or building an apartment complex to rent it out, or there are a number of townhouse complexes that are for rental purposes.
Right.
Secondary rental is essentially something that was likely built for the ownership market, like a condominium townhouse or mm-hmm. a condominium apartment or a single detached home, and somebody has decided to rent out that unit or part of that unit. Like there are a number of single detached homes that have accessory apartments in them.
Mm-hmm.
They may be renting out the accessory apartment.
Right.
The challenge with the secondary rental market is that nobody collects information as to how large it is or what's happening in the market or how stable it is.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, how long is a unit being rented out typically?
Right.
Is it being rented out for 6 months at a time, or are there units out there for 4 or 5 years? So on the primary end of the market, Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation actually tracks what's happening in that primary rental market
mm-hmm.
and releases vacancy reports twice a year.
Right.
So we know what the vacancy rate is like in the primary rental market, but we don't know what's happening in the secondary rental market unless we collect that ourselves.
Would that be helpful in coming up with the numbers that you need to work with for the vacancy rate and for the affordable housing numbers, if there was some sort of mechanism or tool, or if that investment was made to try and figure that out, at least on a local level.
Yeah, I think it's really important to know what's happening in the secondary rental market, because people are living somewhere. They're renting somewhere, or they're owning a unit, and it's important that there's something out in the market. Ideally, it's more secure if it's coming from the primary rental market, but if people are finding things on the secondary rental market, that's still comforting to know that they're finding a place that they can rent.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the reason why we're very supportive of our accessory apartment policies, because we know they provide affordable rental units, because that was one thing that we tracked, was finding out how much people were asking for the rent of those units.
Mm-hmm.
We also looked at what rental rates were in, say, those condominiums being rented out. And we found out that the condominiums being rented out tended to have slightly higher rates than what was happening in the accessory apartments. But knowledge is important for decision-making processes. And the more we know, the better we can target our response,
mm-hmm.
and realize that there are some limitations. So we don't have the security of the secondary rental supply. And maybe that's something that's we have to work with,
mm-hmm.
you know, because that's not an issue I think the city of Guelph is experiencing on its own. I think other communities are finding that
right. Also
because on the ownership side, money's not that expensive to get. Mortgage rates are low.
Mm-hmm.
So there are more people who are able to become owners.
Mm-hmm.
And if they become owners and provide rental stock, well, at least there's a supply of rental stock
mm-hmm.
happening, because we really aren't seeing those larger rental properties happening. The only exception is Joy Life has got a number of buildings that are being constructed on the west side of Guelph, across from the Zaire's building.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first time, probably in the last 5 years, we've had purpose-built rental
being
constructed.
Interesting. There's also, of course, cultural pressures. It's better to be an owner than a renter as well.
There's different preferences.
Yeah.
I don't take a position whether it's better to be one or the other.
Right.
I mean, I was a renter for 15 years and I could have been an owner, but I chose not to.
Mm-hmm.
I just happened to like where I was renting, and it freed up my money to be able to do other things. What's important for us to do is to provide a range of choice.
Right.
And so that people have the option of either, they have enough income to be able to own something and they want to own something, or if they want to be able to rent, they can afford that rent, or there's rental stock out there that they can even be a renter if that's the lifestyle that they want.
Right.
So I don't put a, everybody puts their own value on it. From
right.
a planning perspective, we don't put a value on whether people should be owners or renters. What's important is everybody's needs are met, and we try to empower that or allow that to happen within, you know, what tools and roles and responsibilities we have.
Of course. Putting together a presentation like this, I mean, we're dealing with some fairly complicated terminology, and you've opened it up, not you personally, but the city of Guelph has opened it up to the public at large and saying, give us your input.
Mm-hmm.
What's the challenges for you as someone who sort of lives with this every day, trying to, for lack of a better term, dumb it down for those of us who aren't always thinking about planning and zoning?
Right. So what's really important through a complex project like this is to try to break it down into pieces and to recognize that when you're engaging the general public, they will enter the process at different times and with different levels of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So back in 2014, we actually released a background report that explained different roles and responsibilities in regards to affordable housing, what we even meant by this, reports that we've already done, so that we had that background or starting point for people that wanted to be engaged at that level. The next piece of work that we released, which was October of last year, was a state of housing report. So if you were a numbers person and you wanted to know what's the affordable rent, what's the affordable price, are we meeting our targets or not, what kind of housing is being constructed in Guelph, what's happening with lone parent households, where are the challenges and what kind of issues is that data that's demographic and statistical leading us to see in our community. That report itemizes everything that we were able to collect and sort of scope the issues out. So the report that was released last December, which we're talking about today, is the draft directions report. And that's building on those previous reports. So if people want to understand what's happening in the background, what can the city do, what are the other players like the county doing, what is happening in our community, what kind of issues are we seeing, they have that background and now they know what kind of draft directions we're looking at to address those issues. So this wasn't about just brainstorming what do you think is happening in the community, what do you want to see done. It's been an iterative process so that everything has a foundation of important information. So, you know, why are we doing this is in the background. What do we know about our community and what's happening in the housing market is in the state of housing. What are our issues? We're building on that and the directions are addressing those things. So even though somebody might be coming into the process at the draft direction stage, we're trying to explain the background work and the data that led us to these issues and these directions. So it's a matter of trying to carry people through the process so we get some good information from them and they understand what we're doing and why. And there's an opportunity for us to have some new aha moments, you know, as we go through this process. But we really don't want to engage the community just at the beginning and at the end of something. It really is a process where we're trying to carry them throughout. And you have to give a little bit more of that background if they're just entering the conversation now. So it is a big challenge, and I think people that came out this afternoon were wonderful with their questions. It gave us an understanding of what messages are getting out there and what they're understanding. So when we do actually have a draft strategy out there, they're at a different process, part of the process in understanding what kind of decisions we're making or suggesting for council and committee to consider. It's not from, this is so complex, I don't understand it anymore. We've been trying to do it in concert.
And if people want to get involved in the process, what's the next phase or where can they go online?
Okay, so we certainly understand not one form of engagement works for everybody and people don't necessarily have the opportunity to come out and talk to us in person. So we've got a session this evening, that's the same as this afternoon one. And we also have posted all the questions on PollDaddy, which is on the city's website. There's a separate little button that says take the survey, and it will ask you questions about the 24 directions and some further information about 8 key directions we've identified that deal with financial options and partnerships that we wanted to probe a little deeper. That online survey will be active until February 22nd, so people have the opportunity to connect there. If that doesn't work for them, they can also contact me and we'll try to accommodate the best way you want to provide feedback. Now, each stage of this process has gone forward to committee and council with a cover report. So, and all the background is posted on our website. So if people want to understand more about the state of housing report or the background report, they can do that. And we certainly will be publicly releasing a draft affordable housing strategy before we bring any final product forward. So we've tried to make sure that there are a number of opportunities for the public to be engaged and to help them with that engagement.
And that was Senior Policy Planner Joan Gillan of the City of Guelph. There's a piece now on Guelph Politico where you can read my coverage of the workshop and get links to the city webpages where you can learn more and add your 2 cents to the policy development process. and the affordable housing strategy should come back sometime later this year, probably around the middle point of this year. To wrap up this edition of the Guelph Politicast, I cornered Guelph MP Lloyd Longfield after Thursday night's special council meeting on infrastructure priorities to talk about what he took away from the discussion.
Given what you've heard tonight at City Council, I mean, this is an initial step in terms of the city organizing itself to taking infrastructure money. What are your thoughts so far?
I think it was great to see all three levels or orders of government working together. We are trying to provide some support from the federal. We know we need to cooperate with the provincial on it. And getting the priorities from the municipal really aligns the three orders doing what we're all hopefully going to do together to make Guelph better.
There's been a lot of pressure, and certainly hearing it at meetings here at City Hall, there's a great deal of pressure, a huge infrastructure gap, and this is a nationwide thing. Are you and your fellow MPs feeling that pressure considering the promises made?
Well, we see the infrastructure gap as an opportunity to create employment and economic activity. It's an investment, and the return on investment hopefully is jobs and dollars flowing through the economy, which then will help get more tax revenue to pay off the investments that we're hoping to do together.
And in terms of Guelph specifically, what do you think the challenges are going forward, other than just... it seems like this is coming together rather quickly, and staff has done that work admirably, but in terms of other challenges too.
I think the challenge is time. You know, we are all looking at a construction season right now coming up faster than we're ready for. And so the staff has done a great job at reacting. I'm taking these notes directly to Ottawa, and hopefully we can react as quickly and get some things happening for this summer.
So there is anticipation that with the budget coming later in a couple of months or so, that there will be shovels in the ground, courtesy of federal money, in this coming construction season.
Yeah, we don't want to miss the construction season. That's where the jobs are happening. And hopefully we get people looking at skill development that will then take them into programs in Conestoga and the university in the fall.
Is there any concern given the macroeconomic situation, Alberto, and the oil prices, and a lot of people with their hand out right now? Can the Liberal government still do as much as was promised back in October?
Well, we need to stay to our plan to get economic growth. And right from the start, we said that we have to invest smartly and create opportunities for jobs, get the economy going through investment. Canadians can do better, and now we notice that doing better is a little bit further a gap because of the economy going a little further south than we hoped, but we can get through it together.
You're still optimistic?
I'm always optimistic. We've got a great country, we've got a great community, and just the fact we had all three levels of government in the same room tonight shows our joint commitment to help making things better.
And once again, that was Guelph MP Lloyd Longfield. That's all for this week of the Guelph Politicast. The theme music for Guelph Politicast is provided by the Crazy Pills and their song Break It Down, courtesy of Free Music Archive. For the host of the Guelph Politicast, you can go to Podbean. Guelphpoliticast.podbean.com is where you can listen to the latest episodes. And while you're there, you can also listen to Open Sources Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me via email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me on Twitter at adamadonaldson. There is also a Guelph Politico Facebook page that you can find at facebook.com/politico_Guelph. And of course, you can donate to Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/Guelph Politico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, please consider donating. For all the latest political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.com, where we will also have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you there shortly. And until then, see you next time.